Hello, I'm Jemima Kish, and welcome back to Tech Weekly. On the show this week,
it was like when a friend who's cooler than you sends you a CD and it like changes your life, you know, like it was almost like that, except I invented the friend.
Alex Kotowski talks to Darius Kazemi about what happens when you let a software bot randomly buy you stuff on Amazon.
Video is the most analog part of the web, you know, computers.
And from the random to the very specific, I meet the founders of the video tagging company Wirewax, Steve Callanan and Dan Garraway, about their mission to liberate video on the web. All that and a roundup of this week's technology news, including a tantalising glimpse of Google's smart glasses and the end of Hotmail. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
My name's Darius Kazemi. So I spent 10 years of my career, well, I guess, yeah, since about 2005, I guess, 8 years, I was a game developer. I work in online games and that sort of thing, but always making and doing side projects and that sort of stuff, initially focused on electronics and kind of doing more and more software as I got better and better at programming. And these days, I work as an open web developer, so I make like JavaScript code and that sort of stuff at a company called Boku. But that has played a lot into realizing that the web is a really cool platform for doing lots of interesting work on. So I've suddenly started becoming very creatively prolific in the last couple of years in terms of making weird things that live on the internet.
Delightful things as well. I mean, anybody who's followed the podcast and who's followed my recent work knows that I'm obsessed with serendipity and digitally generated serendipity. And one of the reasons I wanted to speak with you is, I suppose it was last November, I saw that you'd created something literally delightful, which is ultimately the aim of serendipity, which is something called the Amazon Random Shopper. Please tell us what it is.
So the idea was pretty simple. I guess I'll explain the genesis a little bit. I always like the feeling that you get when you order something on Amazon and you forget you did it, and maybe it gets delayed, and then 6 months later you get something and it's like a present for yourself. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting feeling. I like that. That's kind of cool. So I started thinking about ways to automate it. Basically, my artistic process is, that's cool, how can I automate it? which is like the same as my process at work too. It's basically, yeah, it's the same. So
that's wonderfully playful.
Yeah, so I started thinking about this idea, and then I thought, oh, well, wouldn't it be cool? It's kind of cool to, you know, to order stuff for yourself and have it come later on a delay. But what if Amazon could pick something that I might like and send it to me? And then I started thinking about, well, what if there was a slider and you could choose the level of confidence that you would like something, right? So like 100% is stuff on your wish list. You know you're going to like, you know you're going to want it, right? And 0% is completely random. So that was the original idea. I sat down, I started to prototype it. And so originally it was like, oh, you would give it a budget and you tell it how random you wanted it, and then you get to send stuff to you. But the first prototype was complete randomness. And the prototyping process didn't involve shipping it to me, but it did involve getting all the way up to that point and just not pressing the buy button. And I realized that the results from pure randomness were actually really interesting on their own. So whenever I see an opportunity to scope a project down, I take it. So I said, all right, random is interesting enough. Screw the rest of it. We're just going to talk. We're just going to make something that sends me random stuff. And then from there, it started to become more and more theoretically interesting to me as well.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of what it was that you got, because you've received some really interesting things, and certainly as the machine is apparently seems to learn based perhaps on recommendations or anything like that, you know, I want to pick that apart a little bit as well about the decisions that you believe the machine is making. Can you tell me a little bit about your theoretical interest in this? So yeah, it was an interesting question, but how have you pursued that? How has it evolved?
Well, I'm playing with an idea right now about sort of composing with randomness, right? Composing with randomness is different than composing with intentional materials, right? And while I'm not 100% clear where I'm going with this idea, one thing that I do know is that it's a different composition process, and it often involves just seeing what the randomness generates and then sort of theorizing based on top of that and then tweaking the algorithm a little bit from there. So as I was composing with randomness and seeing what kind of stuff, the way it works is I just put a random word, like a random dictionary word, in the Amazon search thing. It's all automated, but it searches for a random word, and then it gets the list of stuff, and then it says, I have $50 to spend. What on here costs less than $50? Okay, that does. Now I have $20 to spend. I'll put a, pick another word out of a hat and then see if there's something that costs less than $20. And then I keep going until I have like $2 left or something. So the composition process was just running this dozens of times, or hundreds, really, right? And seeing what the output looked like. And sometimes I would tweak it a little bit. Like, for example, originally it was heavily biased towards buying me things that had a single word as their name. And that's because if you search for a single word, the top result will be a thing that is called exactly that. And that was interesting, but I wanted to be more random than that. So what I did was I kind of shuffled the results, and then I would start going through them like a pack of cards.
It's interesting that the machine itself does set parameters. You know, the technology that you've developed does set parameters. Otherwise, you would literally, I mean, I have no idea how it would decide what you wanted, except based on size and on, you know, on money.
Right. Yeah. The other parameters that I set were it has to be a DVD, a book, or a CD. And that was simply because originally it was just a size thing. I didn't want it to send me a pair of skis, you know, right? And just have this like giant thing in my house that I didn't know what to do with. And then from there, I realized that that was actually theoretically more useful as well, because this means it's sending me media that I can consume as opposed to, say, a charger for a device that I don't own. Right. It could be amusing to get that in the mail, but there's not too much to say about that. Whereas something that sends you DVDs and books almost seems to have a sense of taste. Like we can't help but project the machine. Oh, this machine is I did a blog post recently about what Amazon thinks the random shopper is, because the random shopper has its own Amazon account. It's separate from mine because God forbid this thing has access to my bank account, right? And goes on a shopping spree. Amazon actually has built a profile of what this random consumer is, because it doesn't know that it's a random consumer. And so far, it seems to just think it's like a science fiction fan who also really likes, who's like really into film theory and stuff. And that's because it happened to buy a DVD of Screamers, which was a 1990s Philip K. Dick adaptation. And it also happened to buy, in a separate purchase, the Oxford History of World Cinema. And so those two together, it's like, oh, well, this is a film buff who likes sci-fi. And then it also thinks it's religious. It's like a religious film buff because it bought a religious book.
So it started to generate, in some ways, a personality for this bot. And I'm wondering if in any way you're learning anything about the recommendation system from Amazon that everybody seems to think is bonkers anyway. Does it have a logic?
I mean, it frankly seems kind of stupid to me. It really just, so far I don't have a lot of data points because it's been running for a few months. I've ordered maybe 9 things from it, right? So it's not a huge sample set, but it seems pretty dumb to me so far. It's just kind of like, oh, it ordered a religious book. It must be religious and belonging to that religion. Okay. And I don't mean dumb. It's like, it's reasonable assumptions, but it's simple. You know, it's probably at its core a lot simpler a system than people make it out to be. The other interesting thing, the other concept that I always am fascinated with, have always been fascinated with, is the concept of apophenia, which is the idea that it's when somebody sees signal in noise, right? Where when you look up at the stars and you see shapes in there, when really it's just random. That's an example of apophenia. And what's interesting is the machine is also experiencing apophenia here, right? This is noise. It's shaped noise, right? Like I feed it parameters and stuff. I'm not just giving it like random letters, right? But Amazon is seeing this random input that is not a real consumer, and then it's projecting a consumer onto it. So that's really interesting to me as well, that a machine is almost, you know, experiencing apophenia as well as a human can.
Well, obviously, given that, you know, so much of technology now seeks data points and then constructs the identity out of all of those data points, you know, you could say that most of the web is iteratively learning about us because of exactly this, because of this apophenia. You know, we are simply a random selection of all of our data points online anyway. And so the web, you know, is symbiotically developing with us as an intelligent entity.
Well, right. But then, of course, the question is, how accurate is this machine's picture of us, right? Like, that's what's interesting to me as well. You know, Amazon is not smart enough to look at random shopper and just throw it out and like insta-ban the account because it's obviously not a real consumer, right? And with good reason. It hasn't done anything that like is wholly improbable yet. But it also, I don't think it would do that because it's not asked to do that. Amazon is not in the job of is not in the business of turning down customers, right? But it's interesting to think about what kind of models these machines are building of us and where they are accurate and where they are inaccurate. And that's kind of tied into a lot of, you know, fear from science fiction movies and that sort of thing. You know, like machines won't really understand people in the far future. And that's going to lead to a lot of conflict or similar.
Of course, it's also quite amusing that in that we're talking about artificial intelligence and, you know, the notion of science fiction is that, you know, early on you received, I can't remember what it was. I've got it.
I'm holding the book in my hands right now. It is Noam Chomsky's Cartesian Linguistics.
there you go.
Yeah. While the book doesn't have anything to do with artificial intelligence, it's actually about, it's actually like a contested history of linguistics. Chomsky himself is a rather towering figure in machine cognition. So I thought it was hilarious that the very first package that I opened from Random Shopper was a book by someone who did a lot of work in intelligent machines.
Brilliantly spooky, is it not? I love that. So what kinds of insights would you say, not necessarily based on the content of what you've received, you know, the wonderful brown packages that you received in the post, of which, you know, you can see on randomshopper.tumblr.com, you can see the sort of fantastic documentation of this process. But what insight would you say in terms of machine learning have you developed based on the existence of Random Shopper?
Well, I don't think I've developed any insights into machine learning per se, other than what I've already sort of explained here, and that I think the Amazon algorithm is perhaps less impressive than it initially appears. My insights have mostly, my biggest insight from this whole project has been one of my initial hypotheses was that getting random stuff in the mail that I didn't pick out for myself would probably feel just as good as like intentional shopping. And it is. I mean, it maybe even feels a little bit better. Of course, that's probably due to the novel nature of the whole experience. But also, the stuff that I get sent is not, it's like, its hit rate is about equivalent to when I go shopping intentionally. So if I go out and pick a book that I think I'll like, you know, there's a certain chance that I'll actually like it. And I'm finding that these random books are pretty much the same for me. It's just interesting that there's not really a difference between having random crap shoveled at me and, you know, going out and making what I think are, you know, reasoned choices about my purchases.
Have there been any greater hits, like closer items that you've received that are closer to you than others, or things that have completely surprised you that, you know, have taken you off in a different direction?
Yeah, absolutely. The second thing that I opened in my first package, the first was the Chomsky book. The second was a CD from this Hungarian electroacoustic composer who did a lot of work in the 60s and 70s named Akos Rozman. And it was incredible music. I really like avant-garde electroacoustic stuff in general. Not that I'm like well-versed in it or anything, but I liked what I'd heard. And to get this, it was just, it was an incredible album and really like it, still listen to it. Looked up some of the guy's other work. It was like when a friend who's cooler than you sends you a CD and it like changes your life, you know, like it was almost like that, except I invented the friend.
If any aspiring PhD student is out there who wants to come up with an interesting research question about this kind of thing, then I'm sure Darius would be very interested. But in the meantime, Darius, thank you very much for joining us on Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Kratosky.
To watch Darius's Amazon shopping experiment, all you have to do is visit his Tumblr, randomshopper.tumblr.com. And now, the latest technology news with Jason Phipps.
This week, Sony has announced its much-anticipated next-generation gaming console, the PlayStation 4. The device features new hardware design to offer superior, quote, lifelike graphics, as well as new social features that will allow gamers to connect and share their experiences. Other notable upgrades include a completely new controller design, a new dedicated chip that will allow gamers to download content whilst playing, and a feature that allows smartphone users to connect directly to the console and use their phones as a remote device. There was some disappointment, though, that Sony chose not to reveal the physical console itself or disclose a price. The tech giants did, however, reveal that the PS4 will be hitting the stores this Christmas, no doubt triggering a battle for living room space with Microsoft's next generation Xbox offering, which is expected to be announced in June. This week, Microsoft have officially confirmed that their long-standing webmail provider, Hotmail, is to be replaced by a new service, Outlook.com, as the software giants look to take on Google's Gmail service. David Law, Director of Product Management for Microsoft, broke the news on the company's official blog this week, announcing that the Outlook service has come out of beta testing and is ready for the general public. Purchased for a cool $400 million in 1997, Hotmail has been Microsoft's staple webmail provider for 16 years, yet has struggled in recent years, coming under criticism for its outdated appearance and lack of innovative features. Microsoft's new service is touted as having a better user interface than its predecessor and includes integration with Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn and Skype contacts, with better controls for managing the inbox, controlling mass emails and sharing files. Experts are claiming that the move is part of a major Microsoft strategy to make their presence known in an increasingly cluttered digital marketplace that is dominated by smartphones, tablets and software from rivals Apple and Google. According to Microsoft, 60 million Hotmail users have already upgraded to the new Outlook service since it was first previewed last July. And although it's a promising start, the company will have some way to go to match Gmail's reported 425 million users worldwide. The beleaguered UK Chancellor, George Osborne, has been dealt another blow after Ofcom announced that its 4G auction, the biggest sale of British Airwaves in a decade, raised just a third of what was expected. The auction raised just 2.34 billion sterling, well short of its 3.5 billion target, and a far cry from the 22 billion sterling that the 3G auction brought in 12 years ago. Ofcom said that after more than 50 rounds of bidding, Everything Everywhere, Hutchinson 3G, Niche Spectrum Ventures, Telefonica UK and Vodafone had all won a share of the superfast 4G airwaves. These new 4G services are expected to launch in early summer. Fresh details about Google's eagerly anticipated smart glasses have been released by the company this week in a YouTube video. The 2-minute video uploaded on the company's official YouTube channel shows the technology being used in a variety of practical situations and will do little to dampen the expectations already surrounding the device. The demo video shows how the glass can be used to take pictures and record video, as well as share content directly via email or social networks. Other features appeared to include Skype-like conference calls, local weather reports and satellite navigation. Voice commands such as, "OK, glass, take a picture," were used to control the device, along with a small gesture-based touchpad and button on its side. The information appears on a small translucent square in the top right of the wearer's field of vision. The product was first unveiled as part of a demonstration at a Google launch event last year, where developers were offered early access to the device for $1,500. Experts predict, however, that the device won't be hitting the shop floors until mid next year at the earliest. And to read these stories and so much more, just go to the best technology website on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology. But as you know, there's too much to read and too little time. So why not check out the Guardian Audio Edition?
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Tracy Thorne, the accidental pop star. Churches step in to fill the gap left by welfare cuts. And in the book review, we consider Frankenstein by Mary Shelley and Wendy Moore's How to Create the Perfect Wife. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hello, I'm Jemima Kish and I'm here with Dan Garraway and Steve Callanan, who are co-founders of Wirewax, which I'd describe as video tagging. Steve, how would you describe it?
I guess that is right. There is a traditional kind of term, video tagging, that's normally associated with kind of metadata that you would manually add to a video. So when you upload a video to YouTube, for example, it asks you to add sort of tag words.
Like old internet.
Yes, absolutely. And with us, it's much more about sort of tagging the sort of physical moving objects that appear within the content. So it's much more specific to the actual features within the content itself. So
more like Facebook photos.
Exactly. So if you're tagging a face in a Facebook photo, it's essentially the same thing.
So tell us about the background that you both came from broadcasting. So how did you make that journey from quite an old-fashioned industry into basically an e-commerce space?
So, yeah, well, we started in production. We ran a production company for near on 10 years, and it was we started in television production doing long-form observational documentaries. And we sort of kind of moved away from that and started doing much more commercial content, so doing things like movie trailers and music videos and adverts and that sort of thing. And then we started doing almost exclusively short-form video content with brands and publishers for online. And it was during creating those videos and actually seeing them out there in the digital web, it was kind of amazing that people were sort of frustrated that they could watch these videos and see all the products that featured in them, but they couldn't actually buy them directly, other than kind of going to Google and searching for them and, you know, going through those sort of channels. So the obvious solution was come up with a piece of technology where people could click on the products themselves and then go directly to the product page and buy them. And that's where the idea for Wirewax came about.
Interactive technology to technology in general has always been attacked from sort of technology people. And I think what's been key about the success we've got commercially, particularly recently, working with broadcasters as well as record labels and fashion brands, is that we've made a product which viewers are enjoying and want to interact with. And, you know, building it as part of the experience. We're now talking about interactive video being 50% of the creative. So not just sort of making a video and then tacking this interactive on the end, right? You know, making videos that are designed to be interactive and experiential. And it's only when that sort of is provided to the viewer, they're going to be engaging, and then henceforth the content creator is going to get some value out of it as well. So, you know, we've been very mindful about keeping the viewer central to the focus, and I think that production background has given us that awareness of getting a good experience.
So Dan, can you describe to us what this would look like? I know you've worked with Nike and Tommy Hilfiger and stuff, so what does that look like on screen for a consumer?
Well, the simplest form of it is probably a Facebook video sort of aspect, to give you an idea. So when you see a face walking from left to right on the screen, you'll actually see an overlay, a sort of subtle point, a call to action over the face or next to the face. And you can click on that and then see, let's say, a Facebook profile. I mean, that's the most simple of use cases. But there is obviously a lot of commercial use in that. So we have people like Nike who will tag a pair of trainers in a feature lifestyle piece, for instance. And you click on that, you can see the product in a bit more detail, click through to buy. And then we also have people like ITV, of course, with The Only Wears Essex, which is everyone's favourite show. And they've got a video where you can click on the characters.
How much appetite is there firstly from consumers? There's a lot of talk about video and how interested advertisers are in video. But what evidence have you got that consumers are really ready for this and that they want their video experience sort of, you know, intermediated by advertisers?
I think we always see this as an alternative to pre-roll and in-stream advertising, which is obviously a disruptive to the viewing experience. What we are doing is offering the viewer the opportunity to click on something when they want to click on it because they are interested in that particular object. And we're seeing that viewers aren't turned off by it at all. Exactly an example that we did with a company called Okini, where they made this video where you could click on the guys and buy the clothes. And they found a 58% click-through rate of from the guys to the product pages. And they made $20,000 worth of sales in just 2 weeks. And they're just a small niche fashion retailer based in East London. And for them, it was enormous. So it proves that people are willing to, you know, engage with video content in this way and even go as far as buying stuff from video.
So if you've got a luxury, high-end fashion brand, it's definitely worth them, according to you, putting the time into quite an intensive project and making this, you know, a one-off commercial beautifully Absolutely. Presented video. But how do you scale that? How do you take that to the mass market? Because you need to achieve some sort of scale, don't you, for this really to take off?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's about. It's a tool. So right now, today, if you upload a video on wirewax.com, we do lots of automation. We already detect faces and automatically motion track those faces throughout the entire video. So that's one job taken out. Most people will tag faces. The second stage is face recognition. So that's where we can identify your friends from your Facebook profile. We can also identify famous faces, perhaps politicians in newsreels. And that's where the product is really going. We're all about automation, making the process from a bit of a creative process, which it perhaps is at the moment, but get to the stage where it could be a few clicks and you're done. And that's key to making it scalable, because there are times, of course, when, you know, that ITV project, for instance, where you want to create an experience for the viewer. You want to build something around the characters and everything else. But for a lot of cases, you just want 10,000 videos tagged and find the commercial opportunities for you. So that's the stage we want to get to.
Well, in storytelling, this is where this could get quite interesting, leaving aside the kind of the obvious e-commerce applications for what you're doing. How can you add rich context around a story or characters, or just contextualise who are you working with in that area? There seems huge potential there.
So we're seeing a lot of record companies doing things where they'll make consumer-facing electronic press kits, which would have traditionally been a sort of internal promotional thing for an artist, which are now, you know, we're seeing music videos being tagged where you can click on an artist and listen to a track from the album, or look at the YouTube videos of the band on tour, or see Instagram photos, all these sort of things, which are obviously incredibly engaging for viewers who are interested in that artist, which they wouldn't normally be able to get. And all these sort of digital assets that otherwise would have been sort of disparately put on other parts of the web are now contained within one shareable, interesting and engaging experience.
You're obviously based in London, but how important is it for you to crack America, and who are your competitors over there?
Well, America's obviously one of the biggest markets, and we've been very fortunate, particularly in the last 6 months. We've now got perhaps 50 or 60 top brands going, ranging from, you know, Nike, Tommy Hilfiger, Levi's, to use the product, and they were inbound sales. All of those people have come to us because they've seen the product and love it. And funny enough, most of them are from the US. So although this tool was built and born here, everything was made in London, it's actually been the commercial centre of the business since its early days, really. And I think that sort of plays to a wider point, which is that the UK, and particularly Europe, is a little bit slower at innovation and possibly slower at just paying for innovation. You know, we'll perhaps try it out for free, but Americans are, in our experience, willing to put up money to it and say, we'll invest in this, we'll actually use it. So that's been, you know, amazing for the growth of the product over there. And, you know, we've now got a team over there as well, account people and biz dev people that are really growing the tool and getting some amazing names in meetings and getting high up the ladder as well.
How many staff have you got in total, and how many in the States?
So there's 12 of us in total, 3 in the United States. And yeah, obviously we're looking to expand that as quickly as we possibly can. That's one of the main challenges for us. And certainly the challenge for many startups is just finding the right people.
Silicon Milk Roundabout, 11th and 12th of May. What hasn't worked? What have you tried that you failed at and has changed the direction of what you're trying to do?
I think it's always difficult because we're changing a medium, and so we are in a constant learning experience with that. We've had to monitor metrics very closely. We've had to go through a lot of experience testing. We hear a lot of things along the way about user experience. For instance, one of the things people often say is this tag is now part of the video experience. That's distracting. You can switch it off and it can be on auto, so mass sensitivity and all that sort of thing. But it's also like you've got to tell people they can interact with a video, and you've got to now think of, you know, WireX being part of the creative, as I was mentioning earlier, with it now being part of the experience. So these user experience learnings are some of the things we have to tackle, because we are having to say, well, no, it kind of has to be like that, because otherwise nobody knows they interact. And these are the things that are quite difficult, because we're trying to obviously not distract people and change an experience for anything but the better. But you've kind of got to be able to progress forward and show a new way of working at the same time. So those challenges are really difficult.
And, you know, we did some testing earlier on, and it was the younger audiences that were not upset about the viewing being, you know, disrupted by something hovering over the top of the video content. It was the older audiences that were, you know, almost turned off.
Old dogs and new tricks.
Yeah, and it was really surprising. The margin wasn't that, you know, that old, really. It was, 35 and above were the people that were getting slightly upset about it, and it was ages below that were kind of expecting it. And I think we're getting to the point where generations coming up are going to be looking at video content and expect it to be as interactive as everything else on
as the web around it. And I think I mentioned this to you before as well. It's like video is the most analog part of the web. You know, computers are interconnected. Every document has an href to another document. And, you know, we are living in an interconnected web. And then you get to the video and it doesn't know what's going on. The video, the computer doesn't understand that, you know, your friends in that video doesn't know there's a product you might be interested in. We don't understand that video other than pixels. And this is key to what we're trying to solve. And all of these challenges are going to be overcome by the viewer being part of the experience of building it.
And that is what WireWax is all about, is making video as intelligent as it should be. You know, a byproduct of doing that is creating a hotspot technology, and that's the kind of our main offering. But it is about making computers understand pixels, that they represent a actor, your friend, or a product you like to buy. That's what it's all about.
Dan and Steve, thank you very much for coming in. That's been really interesting, and it's definitely something to watch.
Thank you.
And a huge thanks to Dan and Steve. To find out more and experience WireWax yourself, you can visit their handsome website at wirewax.com. That's all for this week. Remember to keep up to speed with breaking technology news day and night at guardian.co.uk/technology.
Tech Weekly was produced by me, Jason Phipps, with the assistance of George O'Donnell. The music featured in this week's edition is by the artist Ghost of 3.13 from the album Inwards on the Mozyk label. That's mozyk.net.
From me, Jemima Kish, and our producers Jason Phipps and George O'Donnell, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.